good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And if you're out there across America listening to us on the Internet, we welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. If you're here in the Central Coast, our telephone number, as always, is 464-8295 or 464-TAX-L, like for tax less, if you like to remember it that way. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us an old friend, not old, but a friend that I've known for many years. His name is Anthony Sutton, and he was a resident scholar at Hoover Institute for many years. And his books on Western technology and Soviet economic development, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, Wall Street and the rise of Hitler, Wall Street and FDR, his books on national suicide, on gold, on diamonds, on the Federal Reserve System, trilateralists over Washington. Some of these we have the Federal Reserve book. We have the trilateralists over Washington. We're going to be talking tonight about Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution. And of course, these books point out the fact that since the inception of communism in Russia, it has been financed by the West. In fact, there never would have been any communism in Russia had it not been for the constant infusion and transfusion of finances and technology to the Russians. Now, why would this have happened? Isn't there a conflict between communism and capitalism? I mean, everybody knows that. We're taught that. We're taught that in school. Everybody in the general media, the average American believes that there is a conflict between communism and capitalism. Well, if you were to read the book, Wall Street and the Rise of Bolshevism, or hopefully after our interview this evening, you'll begin to realize that most of what you believe just is not true. Anthony, are you there?
Yes, good evening, Stan. Nice to talk to you again.
All right, well, it's a real pleasure to have you. And in fact, I just started rereading your book, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, and it's fascinating just to go back and see the part that these people from the Federal Reserve Board and those people associated with J.P. Morgan and Company, the great banker and the Rockefellers, the part that they played in actually financing the communist revolution. Now, would you like to tell our listeners what the source of your documentation was? Because didn't much of this come from the State Department files?
Yes. You see, the generally accepted interpretation of the revolution is totally inaccurate. It's based on Marxist sources, and it's based on George Kennan's book, who used to be with the State Department. And what I did, I bypassed that, and I went straight into the State Department files, the major decimal file. Now, this is important, because up to before 1946, when the CIA was founded, the State Department did all the intelligence work. So what I got was the raw intelligence data, as it is today, even in the State Department files, and I based the books on this.
Now, did you actually go back, or would they copy them for you? How did you get that information?
No, there's about 3 million documents in the decimal file, and I didn't read them all. But what they have, they microfilmed the key sections, and you can buy this stuff on microfilm. And 25 years ago, when I wrote the book, I must have bought about 200-300 rolls of microfilm. That's maybe about a couple hundred thousand documents. So what you've got is my books are based on this raw material, which is available to anybody who wants to go to National Archives and check me out. And in the books, of course, I give you the file numbers.
And of course, really what's so fascinating to find out that all you have to do is look and see what this information shows to discover that communism was certainly financed by the great American capitalists, and specifically the names of Morgan and Rockefeller, Thomas Lamont, and Charles Crane, and Thompson, was that Boyce
William
Thompson?
William Boyce Thompson.
William Boyce Thompson. Yes. These names keep coming up over and over and over again. And, of course, this is the one part of the story that the average American does not really understand.
Yes, I think there's a misconception here. These guys weren't communists, they weren't Bolsheviks.
Right.
But it's the way to make money.
Right.
If you want to make money, you don't go out in a competitive marketplace and fight with Tom, Joe, and everybody else. What you do, you get next to government, you get a franchise, you get a monopoly. And the best monopoly you can get is a socialist state, because it cannot progress technologically. So these guys were smart. They said, we don't want Russia as another competitor to the United States. What we'll do, we'll make them a captive, a technological captive and a financial captive. And really, it's quite simple. If you want to make money, you get a monopoly. And the best monopoly there is a socialist state.
And of course, this you
so
start.
From their viewpoint, it makes a lot of sense.
You start your chapter one with a quotation from William Lawrence Sanders, who is the chairman of Ingersoll Rand, who said, I am in sympathy with the Soviet form of government as the best suited for the Russian people. Now, here's the head of a major American corporation saying, I'm totally in sympathy with this totalitarian, ruthless government that's being set up.
He was the deputy chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York as well.
Right. And so here we begin to see the tie-in then between our Federal Reserve, our central banks, and, of course, the institution of this brutal tyranny upon the Russian people. Now, where did Robert Miner fit into this? You have this picture.
Oh, yes, Robert Miner. He was a cartoonist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and he did a brilliant cartoon in about 1911, I think. And he put Karl Marx in the middle of Wall Street, you know, with his beard and socialism tucked under his arm, and surrounded him on Perkins and Rockefeller and Armour and all these big capitalists in Wall Street, and all congratulating him. And congratulating him because he's going to give them the captive market that they want. So everybody's been disillusioned here. You know, the Marxists think that they're fighting the capitalists. They're not fighting the capitalists. They're the biggest allies.
Of course, but the average socialist out there has no idea that he is simply being exploited any more than the average person who's dedicated to free enterprise and who supports this idea of capitalism realizes that the very form of a system of economy that he is supporting is financing his so-called enemies.
But you see, there's a distinction here between your big international bankers, your big multinational corporations, who think in world terms, global terms, and the average guy trying to make a buck on the street running a gas station.
Sure.
And they're two different interests. But as I say, these guys are not communists, they're not Bolsheviks, they're just out to make a big buck.
And they certainly have prospered
worried me, and has done all these years, is the human cost. Because, you know, we build up the Soviet Union, we're building up China, and there's a human cost here. The wars we get into where our men get killed with our own technology.
Right.
That's the problem.
And, of course, the average American has no idea what's going on. He simply rallies behind his government and says, the communists are our enemies. Mm-hmm. That's why the federal government needs more money to build up the technology. But that technology today is being used not to monitor the communists in Russia, but through our satellite technology, through Echelon, through so much of the technology that we have perfected in the name of fighting communism, it is increasingly being used to monitor Americans.
The Cold War was a hoax from beginning to end.
Right.
And we're using our technology against it.
Well, now, who was William Boyce Thompson? Because
Thompson was a very successful mining entrepreneur. He made a lot of money, very closely associated with the Morgans. And he was the key to the implementation of a system to the Bolsheviks. Now, if you read your everyday history, you know, the capitalists were the nasty people trying to suppress the Bolsheviks. That's nonsense, because William Boyce Thompson was in there with money, $1 million, I think, he took in there. And he took the Red Cross mission over there, and they actively supported Trotsky and Lenin in fomenting the second revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution. Now, the interesting point here is there were two revolutions in Russia in 1917. The first one defeated the Tsar, and you got an independent, fairly free Russia for about 6 months.
Under Kerensky.
Yes. And then the second revolution in October, using the Russian calendar, the second revolution was the Bolshevik Revolution, and this is where Wall Street came in and helped them.
All right, and so then we see William Boyce Thompson putting in $1 million, and then, of course, that $1 million in those days was probably equivalent, to $100 million or $75 million today?
That's what, $20, $30 million. You could do a lot with that money in Russia at that time.
And then, of course, Thomas Lamont, a senior partner in J.P. Morgan and Company, didn't he also get some money in there?
Oh, he had money in there. But Lamont is important because he assisted Mussolini in the same way. You see, they weren't only assisting the communists, they were assisting Hitler and Mussolini and the Sun Yat-sen Revolution in China in 1912, Pancho Villa in Mexico.
And so
wherever you go to revolution, if you look hard enough, you'll find some bankers behind it.
And I think that's what people have to understand, that all of these various so-called socialist revolutions have been financed with American capital. Now, of course, then we have the Crane mission. Now, who is Charles Crane?
Charles Crane was another of these entrepreneurs, and what you get is about a half a dozen of these major Wall Street people, each running their own little mission over there, and the missions really were kind of support for the revolution. The most interesting example is the Siberian Railroad. If you read New York Times of that period, you will get the argument that the American forces went in to protect the Siberian Railroad, to keep it away from the Japanese.
No, okay, this was the,
that's
this
not
was,
so. They were preserving it for the Bolsheviks to take it over.
And this was actually in the eastern part of Russia. Right.
Yeah, you're getting very faint, Stan.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you hear me all right?
Just a little bit better, yeah.
All right, fine. And I think that, of course, if we go into the story of General Wrangel, who headed the Army of the South, and of course they were the White Russians fighting the Red Russians, and they ran into the same problem. The British.
Well, of course, Morgan helped the White Russians as well.
Right.
He would always finance both sides. And you get that in Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, where what they do, they finance both sides, because you're back to Hegel, the Hegelian conflict, you know, the dialectic. If you get two sides opposing each other, you get conflict. And business has seen its progress.
Now, then, of course, we get to Leon Trotsky, who was one of the major players in the Second Revolution, in the October Revolution. And you point out that he gets arrested in France because of some revolutionary writings. And then he gets sent to Spain, and he gets a very expensive first-class cell, which he has to pay for. And then you point out that Trotsky actually... comes to the United States, and he seems to have unlimited amounts of money. He's driving around in a car driven by a chauffeur. He has a very affluent middle or upper class apartment in New York City.
He had a refrigerator, which is very unusual in those days.
So where is Trotsky getting all of his money? That's the question.
Because I looked at his income. He wrote some articles. I figured his income was about $300 a year officially, but he had $10,000 in gold at one point. I think it came in from Germany, so far as I can see, through the German newspaper in New York. But he undoubtedly got money from other places as well.
All right, and then, of course, Trotsky's famous trip where he left the United States, went to Canada, at least he was on a ship, where the ship was stopped, and he was impounded by the Canadian government, and then orders came that he was to be released so we could go back to Russia. And of course, when he went to Russia, they carried out the Second Revolution, which destroyed Kerensky's government and imposed the brutal communist tyranny. What's the background of that story?
Well, that's interesting there, that whole story about Halifax and being taken off the boat. First thing, he had a passport, which was issued by Woodrow Wilson. Now, when he was taken off the boat at the orders of the British government, and along with about 10 of his fellow revolutionaries, I think.
And these were hard.
Suddenly, orders came through to release him and let him go on to Russia.
Yeah, but
now, I traced this back to the Postmaster General in Canada, who had a link with New York, and somebody pulled some strings in New York to get the guy released. And finally, the British government turned around and said, release him, let him go.
And of course, the amazing part to me is the fact that it was quite obvious that Trotsky and Lenin, if they were able to create a counter-revolution, would pull Russia out of the war, and that would release the German troops from the Eastern Front to go to the Western Front to kill American boys, and British boys, too. So it would be only logical that they'd want to keep Trotsky locked up. They wouldn't want a counter-revolution.
Exactly. But these guys were thinking much further than the end of the war with Germany. They were thinking about, big markets further down the road. They wanted Russia as a captive market.
And they certainly got Russia as a captive market.
Oh, yeah, they did, as I showed in the three volumes of the Hoover Institution.
Now, basically, the people that we see involved, we see the Morgan interests, we see the Rockefeller interests, we see Armand Hammer. We see Harriman. Who were some of the other capitalists?
Well, Abel Harriman. Armand Hammer is a little different case because his father, Julius Hammer, founded the Communist Party USA.
Right.
And he actually financed the party in the early days. He's a different case, but he had remarkable access, access is the key word here, to every president from Wilson onwards. But the others were basically major capitalists. Evel Hyrman is one of the key ones. And when you come to the Hitler financing of Hitler, you get Evel Hyrman again and Prescott Bush and number of people like that.
Well, of course, we see the same people financing Adolf Hitler who financed the Bolsheviks, and the average American has no idea that. They think that, we were anti-fascist or anti-Adolf Hitler. Now, what about Henry Ford? Henry Ford seems to be involved with both communism and fascism.
Yes, he was. He's a little different case, too, because Henry Ford kind of went off on his own and took these 100 historians to Europe thinking he was going to get peace, but he was actually decorated by Hitler.
Right.
You know, he was because he helped finance Hitler, and also I think some of his money probably went into the Bolsheviks, but he wasn't a major character in the early days.
Well, didn't he actually build the Ford Motor Plant at Corky?
Oh, yes, but that was done by, I've forgotten the name of the corporation now. The Gorky plant is a copy of Ford Motor in Dearborn, in the same way that the Magnitogorsk steel plant is a copy of the U.S. steel plant in Gary, Indiana. You see this captive technology, captive market coming into play. And they pulled it off very well. You see, the Soviet propaganda is they built the first five-year plan, second five-year plan all by themselves. They didn't. The American companies went over there and built it for them.
Now, what about the this Olaf Oschberg? He was, a Swiss banker who actually helped to fund the whole Russian Revolution?
Yeah, well, he was another character in here. Oschberg was the Morgan agent, I think, in Russia before the revolution. And, of course, he did his little part during the revolution, particularly when it came to gold sales. So when the Soviets got established, they had to sell gold, and Oschberg finagled this through to the U.S. Treasury, and there's something in the background here which I haven't fully explored. It was stamped as not being Soviet gold. It was genuine Tsarist gold and therefore could be sold. There were all kinds of things going on where the way was smooth for the Bolsheviks to survive and build.
And, of course, all the time ranting that they were going to destroy capitalism in the West.
Yeah. Well, that's a front. I mean, it's ridiculous, really. In fact, Trotsky made a speech once. On the same day, he said, he made a speech saying, we can never ally ourselves with capitalist Americans. The same day, he visited Ambassador Francis, the U.S. ambassador in Moscow, and asked Francis, please, could he have help from the U.S. Army to train the Soviet Army? And he wanted some rifles and ammunition. So, you know, you get this dichotomy, this two-facedness all the way through this.
Well, now, what about Lloyd George? Lloyd George became the British Prime Minister, I believe, in December of 1916.
Yes.
And, of course, does he go right along with this whole situation?
Well, at first, no. The British cabinet at first was very anti-Bolshevik. Then they had a visit from, I think it was Thatcher, who was a Wall Street attorney. And you see, I went into the British papers, they're now released, the confidential papers, and you find that Lloyd George were flip-flop. He went from being anti-Bolshevik, overnight he became pro-Bolshevik, after the visit by Thatcher. Now, I have the Thatcher memorandum, I think I put it in one of my books, a part of it, and Thatcher made a strong case that we should be supporting the Bolsheviks. And that's what turned the British cabinet.
And, of course, Milner was...
Milner.
And what part did... most of our listeners out there don't know who Lord Milner was, but Lord Milner was the man who was part of Cecil Rhodes' original secret society and certainly one of the dominant forces in creating the Boer War. And then it was his men, his so-called roundtable group, who completely surrounded Lloyd George. In fact, there's a book called Lloyd George's Secretariat, and four of the closest advisor to Lloyd George, the British Prime Minister, happened to come from Milner's secret society, and Milner himself was on the war cabinet, one of the three members of the war cabinet. So did you actually get a chance to explore the part that Milner had played?
Well, Milner was extremely influential. He was, I forget his exact position, but he was a kind of the foreign policy advisor to Lloyd George. And as you say, he ties back to Cecil Rhodes. He was also tied in with the Oxford Group. You know, and out of the Oxford Group came the Council on Foreign Relations in the United States.
Right.
So you can trace all these things, and they all link together as you go along. But you have to look at history in a completely different way. You know, what they're teaching now in the universities is frankly garbage. It is not true. It's not based on the files. And until it's based on the files, people will not be getting an accurate understanding of all this.
And, of course, I remember many years ago I had the opportunity to interview Norman Dodd. In fact, the same time I had an opportunity to interview you back at Bob Jones University. Remember that?
That was weekend. Many years ago, 20 years ago.
Right, and Norman Dodd came there, and he pointed out that the American Historical Society and many of these historical organizations had simply been bought off by grants from the great tax-exempt foundations, the Rockefeller, Ford, Carnegie foundations, and so that the entire thrust of history was changed. And if they couldn't buy and purchase these historians, and some of them, like Beard and Harry Elmer Barnes and others, great giants of the first part of the century, would not be bought off, so they simply created their new historians and got them in as professors.
That's what happened to me at the Hoover Institution. Once I got to a certain point, because I wouldn't toe the line, because I wouldn't write what the establishment wanted written, you know, I was persona non grata from then on.
I know, and of course...
It doesn't worry me in the slightest, because it started me on a whole new career.
Well, of course, really a lot of that came about after you gave a talk at the Republican National Committee.
Oh, yeah, Miami Beach.
Why don't you tell the story of that? Because, of course, this was during the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
And you pointed out that the North Vietnamese were being funded by the United States.
Yeah.
So what could you tell that story? Because that became the basis of your book, National Suicide.
Yes. Well, National Suicide itself was an interesting thing, because after I wrote the three volumes at Hoover, they were delaying publication of the third volume.
That was the Western Technology
Western
and Soviet
technology,
Economic
yeah.
Development, right.
Yeah. So what I did, I saw the game, so I turned around very quietly. I wrote National Suicide and got it published. They found out nothing about it. And also, I went to Miami Beach. Somebody got me to talk there.
Now, this was the Republican convention in
Miami
Beach, right? 1972.
1972, I think
right,
it was.
Right.
And I gave them a summary. I said, look, we're getting men killed over there with their own technology, and this is wrong. And I said that for about 20 minutes, and they moved the TV cameras out, all the copies went out of the press room, and I think it was Lugar. Is it? He's now Senator Lugar.
Right.
I could see him getting red in the face, and when I got back to Hoover, I was told, you know, one more speech like that, and you won't survive, Tony. You know, so it was a tough speech, and it's still available today. People still read it, apparently.
How can our reader get hold of a copy
of
that speech?
There's a book called Best Enemy Money Can Buy, which is put out by Liberty House Press up in Montana, and it's printed in the back of that.
Liberty House Press. Do you have a telephone number or any way to get hold of them?
Liberty House Press?
Right. If not, well, I will get that for our listeners if they want it.
Yes, I can let you have it. I should know it. I've been from my publishers for 15 years. I should know it offhand. But it's Liberty House Press in Billings, Montana.
In Billings, Montana. Okay, well, we'll track that down because that's a book we certainly want to carry here at Radio Liberty. And that book is still in print. That is actually National Suicide, just renamed.
It's renamed, yes. But I wrote the book because I was upset. I could see, I was looking at Magnitogorsk. I could see the Soviet planes. I could see the Soviets in Vietnam. And our men were getting killed by this stuff.
And of course,
it wasn't right.
And of course, the technology that built those Soviet planes was American technology, wasn't it?
Yes. And the steel, and the aluminum, and the rest of it.
And of course, one of the things you pointed out was that the trucks going down the Ho Chi Minh Trail look like Ford motor trucks.
Yes, they were Ford trucks.
And how could the communists have Ford motor trucks?
Well, you see, Ford Motor Company built Gorky, the Gorky automobile plant, the gas plant. And they put out a standard truck, which was also the Soviet military truck. And the Soviets were sending them to North Vietnam. And our pilots were right when they said they looked like Ford trucks. Well, they were Ford trucks, but they were built in Russia.
Right.
There's another interesting point here. Caterpillar Tractor Company. There are more Caterpillar tractors in Russia than there are in the United States.
And, of course, they're built by Caterpillar, a plant that...
Caterpillar put a plant in there. They had three tractor plants, Kharkov, Stalingrad, and another one. And they were building copies of Caterpillar, and they were very smart about it. They didn't try and change the design. They copied it exactly. And they got a good tractor out of it. But these tractors, you see, if you got a tractor plant, you also got a tank plant. This is the same technology. You have to upgrade it and change it a little bit. But if you got a tractor plant, you can produce tanks. So anyway, those pilots are right, and this is what was upsetting me back in 1972. I mean, this was a... This is a con game which is killing people.
And, of course, wasn't the radar technology that they were using to target the North Vietnamese anti-aircraft weapons our planes? Actually, our technology was given to Russia?
Yes, it was ours, but not only that, and this has not come out too much. The Soviets were actually in North Vietnam training and utilizing the equipment on behalf of the North Vietnamese.
But I think the most incredible part is that we were giving Russia or lending money to Russia, I think something like $40 billion from America and our allies up to about 1974. Wasn't that the figure?
Yes.
And, of course, the thing is that most of that has simply been written off, and then we continue giving them more money. And
right,
they
just
defaulted on a $100 billion loan within the last 2 or 3 months. And how did we respond? Why, we gave them more money.
And we're doing the same with China today.
And, of course, the average American has no idea because, of course, when Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, and Barbara Walters tell them that there's a conflict between communism and capitalism, and they repeat it over and over over again, they come to accept this as fact.
Now, you see, the problem is the book distribution is controlled.
Yes.
I can give you an example right here. This book you were talking about, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, when it came out, and Publishers Weekly comes out each week, and they put 2-3 lines in every book that comes out, and this Publishers Weekly goes to all the bookstores. And my book got the number one listing, and I didn't get 2 lines, I got 4 inches of text in Publishers Weekly. And the reviewer at Publishers Weekly, they gave a very fair review of the book.
I'm going to ask Barbara if she'll come in here, please, go right ahead, please.
They gave a very fair review of the book, but not one bookstore ever carried it. So something happens between the review of the book in Publishers Weekly and the bookstores. Now, the Internet has changed all this. That's one of the great advantages of the Internet. Now this information is becoming available.
And I think it's so vitally important that people do understand that books are actively suppressed in America, contrary to everything we hear. And there is an organized effort to block the distribution of information. And certainly your book, Western Technology and Soviet Economic Development, you commented that they actually withheld the publication of that for a time.
But there's another interesting point here. They held that up for 18 months. But they have kept it in print for 31 years.
Oh, so
it's still available. It's still in print. My guess is that they would look, if they take it out of print, the rights come back to me, and they don't want me to have the rights. That's my guess.
Well, let me tell our listeners, I have all 3 volumes. It's a fascinating book. In fact, a fascinating set of books. In fact, Zygmunt Brzezinski even talks about Professor Sutton's work in his book, Between Two Ages, and acknowledges the fact that it really is true that they're not getting the information. I'm going to ask Barbara if she'll come in here, if she'll call the engineer, because we just lost our internet connection, and I know that there are people out there across America who are trying to get this pretty looking forward to hearing this. So if Barbara will simply call our engineer, and we'll see if we can get hooked back up again. Under any circumstances, when we were talking about the Vietnamese War, wasn't it primarily American technology that was involved in the ships that were bringing the weapons of war?
Oh, yes, that's another interesting situation, the Soviet shipping. What I did, I got the Soviet Register of Shipping. Now, they had to publish that because Soviet ships are going into ports around the world, and the harbor masters need to know the details of the ship. Now, in the Soviet Register of Shipping, I found a complete description of every engine of every ship, including the manufacturer of the engine. So I went through 6,000 entries, and I think I found that 80% of their ships have been built outside the Soviet Union. All their marine diesel engines.
I'm going to have to interrupt you there. We've just suddenly come to the point where I hate to do that, but we've got to take a break right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And if you're out there across America or even the Central Coast area listening to our program, we hope that many of you will decide that now is the time to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And, of course, this is how we maintain our coverage here in the evening. Now we maintain our afternoon program of the 22-23 stations that we're on across America. It's really your contributions that allow us to have the voice, and if you believe in what is being said here, if you believe the information we're putting out is vitally important to the American people, they have to understand that the Cold War was a scam. The end of the Cold War is a scam, and of course what's going on today is going to lead us to the eventual loss of all of our freedom as we move from freedom back into feudalism with a ruling aristocracy. And this is our concern, that the average American has no idea of history or of what's going on today. And the purpose of Radio Liberty is to bring you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. And so we hope that many of you will decide, I want to become part of somebody who's doing something, part of the team, the Radio Liberty team, and for a suggested gift of $20 a month or more, why, you can get our four best tapes, you can get our newsletter, and you can help us to get the information out across America. It's as simple as picking up your telephone and calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we are at war. America is under siege today. Again, the telephone number, and we hope many of you will decide tonight that you want to become part of the team, 1-800-544-8927. Okay, Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. Now, if you're out there across America and you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And here in the Central Coast, 464-8295. So give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. And if you have a question or comment on what you're hearing tonight. Now, we certainly were talking with Anthony Sutton, who for many years was a research fellow at Hoover Institute. But of course, contrary to what most people believe, Hoover Institute being the great bastion of anti-communism, when Professor Sutton began to write about how we had financed communism since its inception, he came under tremendous, tremendous pressure and eventually was forced out of Hoover Institute because there's certain things that scholars are not supposed to investigate. And of course, most of that is the fact that since the inception of communism, it has been funded by great American banks and great American corporations. And so we've been talking about, first of all, his trilogy of books, Western Technology and Soviet Economic Development, which is the classic analysis, documentation of the fact that since the very inception of communism, it was funded by the West. And then, of course, we get into the three books, the so-called Wall Street Trilogy, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, and then, of course, Wall Street and FDR. And I think, of course, one of the most shocking parts of this whole trilogy is the fact that we actually funded Adolf Hitler. I think that when you begin to realize the funding that came to Hitler to allow him to build up his war machine, to finance his expansion of his power over the German people, this is the part that I think is most shocking to the average American. Who were the people who were funding and financing Adolf Hitler?
Well, the funding from the United States went through a Union Banking Corporation in New York and to a Dutch bank. That was to disguise the flow of funds. Now, from the Dutch bank, it went to the Schroeder Bank in Germany to an account run by Rudolf Hess, I think. Now, the Union Banking Corporation in New York, very interesting. I think it had eight directors, four of which were Dutch Nazis, and the other four were members of Skull and Bones, the Yale Secret Society. And that included Harriman and Prescott Bush, the grandfather of the present Bush. And that was the main funnel for U.S. funds. Of course, there were other things. Hitler was assisted with technology. There's no question about that. For example, Standard Oil sold the hydrogenation patents to make oil from coal in about 1927, I think. And there's no way Germany could have gone to war in 1939 without the synthetic oil, because Germany just has no oil deposits.
And of course, the formula for making ethyl high octane gasoline came from Standard Oil as
well. It's a corporation, right. Yes.
And then, of course, the thing that all during the war, why we had the American plants, General Motors, General Electric, AT&T, Ford Motor Company, they were all producing the war materials for Adolf Hitler.
Yes, definitely, yes, yes. Not only that, but there was something quite interesting. In 1944, the Chase Bank was still operating in Nazi-occupied France in 1944, and it was actively soliciting Nazi accounts. So here you've got Chase Bank operates in the United States, which is at war with Germany, and you've got Chase Bank in Paris, who's trying to get accounts from the Nazis.
And then, of course, where does IG Farben fit into this whole incredible story?
IG Farben is interesting, too, because a number of the directors were American. And IG Farben was a big backer financially of Hitler. And this is absolutely confirmed, because in the Hoover Institution, I found the bank transfer slips. From the Schroeder Bank.
Right, and so many of the directors of IG Farben were actually Americans.
Oh, yeah, they're Americans. I forget their names offhand, but very definitely. And there was a thing called Himmler's Circle. These were people, you know, who wanted access to Himmler, and so they became part of the circle, and they gave money to Himmler, and quite a number of Americans involved in that.
Well, that's incredible. We've got Fred on the line. Hi, Fred. Did you have a question or comment?
Yes, for Professor Sutton. Some years ago,
I may have to repeat it. Go ahead, Fred, and I'll repeat your question.
Some years ago, Mr. Sutton wrote a book, The War in Gold, and I wondered, is that war still in progress, or has it been won, or how are things now?
Did you get the question?
Yes, something about the war on gold,
yes,
and whether the war is still in progress.
Right.
Well, yes, you had a very interesting case a few weeks ago where the Bank of England announced it was going to sell 25 tons of gold. Now, my question is, who's going to buy that gold? If you've got to sell it, you've got to have a buyer.
And, of course, would any person on Wall Street announce, I'm going to sell 1 million shares of stock in my company, because
exactly.
It would drive the price down? The only reason that they made that announcement was to drive the price down.
Yeah.
It's all manipulated,
Fred. It's a gut check, as I call it.
Right.
I mean,
it's trying to shake out the holders. So, I mean, if I'm right, then the price of gold will rise probably after Y2K next year.
Right. Anything else, Fred?
I had another comment that I just wanted to make. Is there any difference, any moral difference, between what the Japanese did at Pearl Harbor and what our armed forces did in Serbia?
Moral difference? No. Both of it's aggression.
What's that?
Both of it is aggression. In other words,
both of it is aggression.
Right.
It's not moral in my book.
Right.
I mean, if Milosevic was such a, you know... there are other ways of getting someone out of power without bombing the hell out of Kosovo and everyone else.
And killing all the civilians.
And killing all the civilians.
But not killing Milosevic. We never tried to target Milosevic.
He's still there,
right,
along with Saddam Hussein.
Right. And so we kill the people, but we leave the chief of state in power, so we'll have somebody to negotiate with.
Of course, there's money in that. There's big contracts in that. But there's one very interesting thing. I noticed the way they conduct wars these days has changed considerably. They're very careful not to get anyone killed on our side.
Right.
That's the difference, I think. But, of course, you still got Yugoslavs and Iraqians being killed.
Okay, anything else, Fred?
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Let's go to Tony in Soquel. Hi, Tony.
Yeah, good evening. Hi. Well, it's really great to hear Anthony Sutton. really something. The question I had to do with what you were talking about before, the last caller, about Adolf Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering what Professor Sutton had to say about the early financing of Hitler and General Electric and how the Roosevelt family fit into this.
All right. The question was the early financing of Adolf Hitler, General Electric, and the Roosevelt family.
And, well, there's a lot of different. There was financing through General Electric, through Osram, through IG Farben America, and the Standard Oil. That's the financing aspect. But there's another interesting aspect. There was a cousin of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Punzi Hamsteckel, who was one of the inner circle of the Nazis. He was at one time a U.S. military attaché in Berlin, I think, and then he joined the Nazis and actually was right on the inner circle advising Hitler. And he was a cousin of Roosevelt. Now, about 1944, I think he got out of Germany. He went to Canada, and I think Roosevelt got him down to the United States. Okay. So you've actually got a family, Roosevelt family member on the inner circle of the early Hitler movement.
Okay, anything else, Tony?
Yeah, don't mind. I'd read several books about several of the Rothschilds who were actually helped to escape from Hitler's regime when, you know, during his when he was actually supposedly going after the international bankers and the Jews that he had so much hatred for, but yet he was letting the Rothschilds out.
Well, I don't know. Well, let's ask Professor Sutton.
I don't know about the Rothschilds.
I think you're thinking of the Warburgs, Tony.
No, it was the Rothschilds. Yeah. In fact, I remember
a picture. Let me put it this way. When Hitler was persecuting the Jews, there were some, not many, but there were a few German bankers who wanted to save their own skins, so they helped Hitler. That I do know. I can't remember their names offhand.
Okay, I think that that's right, Tony. I don't remember anything about the Rothschilds either.
No, I don't remember anything about the Rothschilds.
It was a very obscure couple of books.
Okay, fine. Anything else?
Just the role of the Federal Reserve in this whole buildup of Hitler.
Okay, I'm gonna cut you off, and can you listen on the radio? Okay. What was the role of the Federal Reserve System in financing of Hitler? And I think that is really one of the most important issues here.
Well, that one I haven't looked at, Stan. I've looked at it in the Bolshevik Revolution, and there were two or three directors of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York who were very active in helping the Bolsheviks. When it comes to Hitler, I really haven't looked at that.
Well, there is a speech given by Congressman McFadden, who was chairman of the House Banking Committee, and I have a reference to that, pointing out in the mid-30s that, you know, when there was just no money to get the American economy going, and people were out of work and people were losing their homes, and yet he went before the floor of the House of Representatives and said, with no money here to get our economy moving, the Federal Reserve is shipping hundreds of millions of dollars to Russia and to Germany, and I do have that reference. But the average American, of course, has no realization that we have continued subsidizing both Russia and then, of course, the Nazis since the inception of both regimes. So these are just important books. And let me recommend to you Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution and Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler. And one of the most distressing parts of the book, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, was the bombing patterns which you analyzed after the war. And wasn't there specific orders? We were not to hit the war manufacturing plants that were built or owned by American corporations?
That story has been going around. I did check IG Farben, and the IG Farben plant was not badly hit at all. But the others, like the Opel plant, General Motors, I'm not too sure about that. I did look at some of the bombing records they have. They're quite substantial, but I didn't spend too much time on that.
All right, fine.
But there is, from people I know, that they say that this is a fact.
All right, fine. So,
but I haven't looked at it personally.
I don't want to misquote you then. I know Harry Martin, who has done a lot of work, he used to be with the intelligence, has come out with information on that. Now, of course, we find this strong relationship between General Electric, Standard Oil of New Jersey, General Motors, Ford Motor Company, all of them seem to be right in bed with the Nazis from the very inception, weren't they?
Yes. But quietly, not too obviously. And at the same time, they were building up the Soviet Union.
And of course, it was sort of this old analogy, the best enemy that money can buy. And then, of course, we see the same thing going on with China today, and nobody can understand why we keep giving most favored nation treaty status to the Chinese communists, the wicked Chinese communists, and why we keep pouring money into the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and Goldman Sachs and Lehman Brothers and General Motors. We just can't understand why the same people are doing the same thing in communist China that they did in Stalin's Russia, Lenin's Russia, in Hitler's Germany.
That's interesting. Is it that they don't know?
Well, they really
don't care.
No, I think that they really don't know. I think that there isn't a tremendous apathy out there. But, of course, what we try to do with our programs is to educate people and help them to learn these things and say, look, if you don't believe us, you can certainly check out the writings. Now, you mentioned that Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution is now being printed by somebody in the East.
It's out. It's been reprinted. I made an agreement in January of this year. In a library edition, it's very expensive, it's $36, and it's being put out by Buccaneer Books in New York. I'd like to get a cheaper edition out. This is it was only a small edition, I think 750 copies of each volume, but at least it is available.
All right, fine. So that these are available, and there is a fellow named George Gabrick who runs GSG Publishers, and he has the paperback of that. I don't know. He said he bought them from somebody, and they are available as well. And
we've got
Chris from Oregon. Hi, Chris. Hi, from Oregon. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing fine. I'm doing fine, and I want to thank you for taking the time to put this greatest gentleman on the airwaves.
Do you listen to our program regularly on the Internet?
No, I don't. I was trying to listen to it today, and I was having some trouble, but I heard a little snippet.
All right, fine. Did you have a question or comment?
Yes. My basic comment was on his book, The Best That Money Can Buy.
The Best Enemies That Money Can Buy, right. That's the National Suicide in reprint form.
Right. I was wanting to have him comment about that and about the current China scandal and how they, if they relate at all.
Okay.
Well, I see a duplicate in the China situation. We're doing today with China what we did, with the Soviet Union and everybody else. You got the example of Loran, Bernard Schwartz, who sold his missile guidance technology to China. And that's the thing that Reno is trying to cover up right now. And it's the same thing.
And, of course, we're always trying to say, well, it was this this spy that was working in Los Alamos or something. And I don't believe it was a spy. I believe we've been intentionally transferring our technology all along. But we have to just blame it on somebody.
Somebody, yeah. That's right.
And this is the fall guy. I mean, this is all to keep the American people from understanding how the game is really played.
I know this, but they haven't charged him with anything.
Right.
And it gives the, it gives them something to say that, oh, Clinton is working with the Chinese, and it gives the rabid anti-Clintonite something to grab onto. And does Mr. Sutton have any comments about, China and the Skull and Bones people that, I know he's done some research on?
All right. The question is there any connection between the Skull and Bones Society and the continued financing and support for Communist China? Certainly George Bush, Skull and Bones, and basically I'm sure that, George Bush, even after Tiananmen Square, refused to cut off most favored nation treaty status for Communist China.
Well, you see, making money is more important than things like human rights. That's what it comes down to.
Well, I think one of your most fascinating series of books was your books on the Skull and Bone Society. You called it The Order. Is that book still in print?
Oh, yes, very definitely. It's from Liberty House Press, Billings, Montana.
All right, we are going to get in touch with
them then. They've had that book in print for 15 years.
Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about the Skull and Bone Society?
Well, that was a secret society founded in 1830 in Yale. Actually, it's a chapter of a German secret society.
Right.
And I'm sure they don't want to talk too much about that. But they have 15 new members every year, and these people are extremely influential.
Now, is George Bush Jr., the current Republican presidential candidate, is he a Skull and Bones?
Oh, yes.
As was his father, as was his grandfather.
And grandfather.
Right.
And the grandfather.
Right. That's Prescott
and,
Bush.
And if you look at, say, the story of Prescott Bush, you'll see the tremendous influence these people have. They get in all the key positions. There's only about 600 of them around at any one time. But they're put into key spots where they can influence policy, influence the way things go.
In fact, there's a wonderful movie that was sort of a takeoff on this. It was called The Brotherhood of the Bell with Glenn Ford. And if you haven't seen it, I'd suggest you get it, Chris. If you don't know how to get it, let us know.
That was pretty close.
It really was.
I have seen it. Very, very good book. And, even his George W., his paternal grandfather was Skull and Bones, too.
Who is that?
George Herbert Walker.
Walker, yeah.
Right.
Banking family out of Missouri somewhere.
And, of course, we find Averell Harriman there.
Yeah,
we find
that was the key one.
And, of course, there's so many people tied into finance who tie into this secret society from Yale.
I don't think it's the whole answer.
No, well, of course, it's part of the answer.
I think what it is, you've got an elitist group who managed to get control of the state apparatus, and they're working it for their own ends.
Right.
And I don't think it's any more than that. I don't think it's political. I think it's just plain greed, frankly.
And, of course, they all help one another, and you join the secret society.
Yeah.
You're made for life as long as you go along with the agenda.
You have to go along. If you want to get along, you have to go along.
Right.
Because that was my misfortune. I just refused to go along.
Well, but you've had a fascinating life.
I have.
On the front lines of this battle, and you've provided so much.
I should thank these people, you know, for persecuting me, because really, they opened up so many opportunities and so much new knowledge.
Well, now, of course, you know, your book on diamonds, is that still available? Your book on gold?
Yes, that's definitely still available.
Is that the same Liberty House that has that?
No. Let me see. There's a bookseller down in Burbank, Atlantis Books in Burbank. And they bought a whole stack from me just recently.
I see. So
it's still around.
And so, of course, this ties into the South African diamonds.
Yes.
And, of course, there's always that underlying theme, you know, of somewhere the descendants of Cecil Rhodes, who originally controlled the diamonds of South Africa, probably have some tie into De Beers at the present time. But have you looked into that at all?
De Beers' connection?
The De Beers' connection to the Rhodes connection.
Oh, yes. Well, of course, Rhodes made his money out of diamonds and gold, and he devoted it to this secret society. And the Oppenheimer family, of course, is still very influential today in South Africa, as well as elsewhere. In fact, they control the world diamond market.
They certainly do, and talk about a cartel.
But you see, it's not political. I don't think it's political at all. It's money. They can make more profit that way.
Okay.
If you can control the diamond market, you don't care what government is in South Africa, black, white, or anything else, as long as you can control it.
Amen to that. Anything else, Chris?
Well, just any comments about what's going on in the gold market today? You have...
Well, yeah, I just mentioned that. I'm very suspicious of the 25-ton sale. I mean, who's buying it? That's what I want to know.
Chris, Professor Sutton had already commented. He thought that this is simply to drive the price down so that it will go up later on. But right now, when the price is falling, nobody will buy.
You bet.
Okay, thanks,
Thank
Chris.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. You know, you've written a book on gold, on diamonds. You've written the Order, which was actually three books combined on the Skull and Bone Society. You have a wonderful little book out on the Federal Reserve Conspiracy. That's a book we carry here at Radio Liberty. But I've got to pick up all of these others because I really want to have them available.
There's 26 of them out there, but they're not all in print.
Isn't the Federal, because we still get the Federal Reserve conspiracy from...
Yeah, that's in print. Yeah,
right.
That's out of Oregon, I think. Yeah,
right.
That's in print. But some of the others I have to get reprinted somehow.
Well, I do know somebody who'd contacted me, because they could reach you personally and asked me about that. And so I'll talk to them. And which books actually need to get back in print?
Well, I've got the Wall Street series back in print,
right.
But it's a very high-priced edition.
Right.
I'd like to see a cheaper edition.
Right, certainly.
And that one. And certainly that. And I've got another one, Wars and Revolutions, in two volumes, which was Hoover didn't do a good job on that one. They just took it off the shelves. It was too deadly, because it showed that the state is responsible for war. And I traced all the casualties back to 1820, and I found... 200 million people are being killed over the last 150 years.
Well, that's maybe we could talk about that. Anyway, we've got Jim from Santa Cruz here. We're just about out of time. Jim, do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, a quick question. I was wondering, Mr. Sutton, if you'd ever looked at the General Electric symbol. And I noticed it to me, it kind of looks like a swastika. Do you think it's a swastika?
The symbol of General Electric, I don't even know what it is.
Yes, I can visualize the symbol. I've never looked at it until you reminded me.
Okay.
What does the listener think it refers to?
He thinks it's a swastika.
Well, I don't know. It'd be a bit of a stretch of my imagination.
Okay, Jim, anything else?
Yeah, I'd just like to mention to whoever's listening that... McHenry Library at UCSC, they have a copy of Mr. Sutton's Western Technology, Soviet Economic Development.
Okay, but apparently it's still actually in print.
Oh, yes,
if anybody wants to get it.
31 years.
Right. So the book actually can be gotten from Amazon.com.
Oh, yes, if you look at Amazon, you'll find it's probably the number one seller even today.
Okay,
it's
thanks.
It's probably the best seller Hoover ever had.
Thanks very much, Jim.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, we're just about out of time, and I really want to thank you so very much for being our guest this evening and covering these issues, because this is so vitally important. Is there any sort of closing thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners tonight?
Well, I think that this right-left, you know, dispute we've got is not getting us anywhere. It's really come down to the individual versus the state. Because apparently these elitist groups get control of the state apparatus and they use it for themselves And they fool everybody with this sucker bait, as I call it. You know, we're going to do this for you, we're going to do that for you. I think it's come down to us versus them.
Amen to that.
Us being the individual.
And, of course, it is always this perpetual battle between this desire of the individual for freedom.
Yes.
And the effort by those who really would rule us, the aristocracy, right, and to reinstitute a feudalistic or fascist system. It doesn't really matter what you call it. It is the loss of individual
freedom. That's right.
Freedom.
I think that's what we have to realize. It's not a matter of right and left or, you know, communism and socialism. It's a matter of the individual versus the state.
Amen to that. Well, thank you, sir, very much, Anthony. I really appreciate your being with us, and we'll be talking in the not-too-distant future.
Okay, thank you, Stan.
Bye-bye, and God Bye-bye. Bless you. Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan here at Dr. Radio Liberty, and I hope you enjoyed that interview as much as I did. We've got a great interview coming up the next hour. I hope that it won't be too complicated. It's with one of America's leading biologists. He was a professor at USC. He has a PhD. He has an MD. And we're going to be talking about stealth viruses and, of course, how we got these viruses by these bizarre experiments that were done where they would breed the monkey viruses and animal viruses so they would infect human beings. And suddenly we've introduced all sorts of viruses into our environment that can attack you and your mind. And so I don't even think about changing that dial. We'll be back in just a moment or two with Professor John Martin.